The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spergata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Gretchen Rubin is titled, Why Celebrating St. Patrick's Day Could Make You Happier. Over the past years, we've all gone through some very tough circumstances, and they're not over quite yet. And with the relentless monotony of life right now, endless Zoom calls, juggling working from home with remote learning, the occasional socially distanced gathering, even the usual celebrations and milestones still seem dull and flat. That's why, now more than ever, I find it helpful to celebrate minor holidays, such as Groundhog Day, the spring equinox, or even April Fool's Day. These celebrations can add a note of joy to everyday life. In fact, research shows that the celebration of traditions allows families to happily mark the passage of time, which in turn gives people a sense of anticipation, continuity, and inclusion, not to mention the reminder that traditions can be fun. I myself usually celebrate smaller holidays with a festive breakfast. For instance, on Valentine's Day, I used my heart-shaped placemats, dyed my daughter's milk pink, cut her toast into a heart shape, and dressed up the table with a pop-up vase of paper flowers and other fun decorations. For St. Patrick's Day, I'll do something similar. I'll use our shamrock-shaped paper plates, confession, I've been reusing the same set for years, light a green candle, dye the milk green, and put up some of those jelly window decorations. If you're really feeling festive, you could even whip up a traditional Irish breakfast, complete with fried bacon, sausage, eggs, tomatoes, and mushrooms, as well as baked beans, black pudding, and toast. These kinds of traditions are joyous, and even better, they're easy. While the major holidays, like Thanksgiving and Christmas, are of course delightful, they can also be a lot of work. I can prepare for a minor holiday, though, in under 10 minutes with just a handful of supplies. Pro tip, I reuse the same decorations each year so I don't have to spend money or run extra errands. It's a good reminder of one of my favorite secrets of adulthood, which I've copied from Voltaire. Perfect is the enemy of good. In other words, I want to keep these celebrations simple and quick to set up so they don't become a burden. It's extraordinary how just a few small touches can make a day feel special. I keep everything I need for these minor holidays on one kitchen shelf, but honestly, fanciful use of food coloring alone is probably enough. You can turn peanut butter black for Halloween, make bright yellow popsicles for the summer solstice, or serve red and blue pancakes for Flag Day. This year for my April Fool's Day trick, I may dye the water in our toilets bright purple. That should be a shock. But does it leave a stain? I need to do some research. A friend celebrates a minor holiday in a different way. On the first day of school, she takes a photo of her son holding a sign with a date and his grade. She frames the picture, and then each year, as part of her family's back-to-school preparations, she puts out all of the photos, which show her son growing and changing. His favorite shirt in kindergarten, that one particularly funny haircut, that bad sunburn, all those memories come back. Not only does her family really enjoy looking at them, but because they're on view for just 1 week, the images don't fade into the background, as so often happens with photos displayed year-round. I've even created a similar photo gallery for Halloween, which in my household, however, has morphed from a minor holiday into a major holiday. During this pandemic and beyond, I want to always make time for silliness, for fun, and for happy memories. I can make that effort at any time, but as I've often found, things that can be done at any time are often done at no time, which is why I'm a big fan of using a minor holiday as a friendly reminder. The days are long, but the years are short. This kind of simple tradition allows us to mark the passage of time in a pleasant way and to add a note of whimsy to everyday life. And gosh, we all could use a bit more whimsy right now. Our next article by Bridget Earley is titled, 20 Traditional Irish Foods and Dishes to Try on St. Patrick's Day. When you think about traditional Irish food, the first thing that probably comes to mind is corned beef and cabbage. But it turns out corned beef is not among the Emerald Isle's national dishes, says David McCain, the executive chef of Kilkea Castle in County Kildare. The connection with St. Patrick's Day specifically originates as part of Irish American culture and is often part of celebrations in North America, he says. This might lead you to wonder then, what do people who live in Ireland eat on March 17th? As culinary historian Regina Sexton told Irish Times, defining Irish cuisine can be a difficult endeavor. We don't seem to have a culture of food that is based around cooking, the enjoyment of food, and the production of signature dishes that are automatically associated with the country, and therein lies the problem of trying to define an Irish food culture, she said. Rather, it's more about the high quality of ingredients such as meats, potatoes, and cabbages. The coastal region of Galway, for example, is known for cinnamon-coated Irish potato candy that complements a heavy stew, as well as berry fool, a sweet airy custard, and excellent oysters. Galway even hosts an international oyster and seafood festival, the oldest oyster festival in the world. Still, there are plenty of distinctly Irish recipes that have long been staples of the culture, from soda bread to a seriously tasty trifle. Whether you're looking to celebrate your heritage or host a super authentic St. Patrick's Day party, we asked Irish chefs to share all the traditional foods and snacks to know. We hope you enjoy potatoes in their many forms. Number 1, bacon and cabbage. Traditionally, Irish bacon, a lean, smoked pork loin similar to Canadian bacon, was the most ubiquitous meat on the table in Ireland, namely because it was cheap, says McCain. But when Irish immigration to the United States exploded, immigrants found the cost of pork in this country to be prohibitively expensive, so they began cooking beef instead. As a result, bacon and cabbage is technically the more traditional Irish dish. Corned beef and cabbage is the Irish American variant. Number 2, Irish soda bread. Irish soda bread is a quick bread made without yeast. It rises because when combined, baking soda and buttermilk act as a leavening agent. According to the Complete Irish Pub Cookbook, the bread is usually scored with a cross to help it rise. Irish folklore says this also helps ward off evil and let the fairies out. Number 3, Irish stew. An easy and flexible meal that's commonly considered the national dish of Ireland, says Amy Lawless, an Irish-American and co-owner of the Dearborn in Chicago. Though generally made with mutton, onions, carrots, celery, and potatoes, Irish stew can also be created with beef or chicken, she explains. Number 4, Irish coffee. Isrish coffee isn't your average cup of joe. It's a cocktail that's made with a strong hot coffee, Irish whiskey like Jameson, and sugar, says Amy Lawless. The whole thing gets topped with a thick head of whipped cream. Number 5, corned beef and cabbage. Of course, corned beef and cabbage still pops up on many a dinner table come St. Patrick's Day. According to the Complete Irish Pub Cookbook, traditionally the brining liquid included is saltpeter, a bactericide that helps produce that ultra-pigmented pink color. This is one dish you're going to have to plan ahead for. To properly brine the meat, you need to give yourself at least a week. Number 6, Colcannon. A staple side dish on many Irish tables during the winter, this comfort food is a mixture of braised white cabbage and creamy mashed potatoes, says Joe Scully, an Irish chef and owner of Chestnut and Corner Kitchen in Asheville, North Carolina. Number 7, crew beans. Also known as pig's feet, crew beans are generally fried and eaten by hand, though they can also be braised, says Scully. Number 8, Irish seafood chowder. Like Irish stew, Irish seafood chowder is a very adaptable dish that contains a variety of seafood, like salmon, trout, and shellfish, as well as vegetables like celery and potatoes, says Scully. Number 9, Boxty. Similar to latke, Irish boxty is a potato pancake you make by mixing grated potatoes into mashed potatoes before frying like a patty, says Scully. Though some consider it to be among the stranger Irish dishes, it's actually a very versatile side. Number 10, cured salmon. Ireland is globally renowned for its smoked salmon, says McCain. It's served all day long and can be found everywhere from breakfast buffets to afternoon tea to dinner. Number 11, Dexter beef. This type of beef is native to the island of Ireland, says McCain. It's regarded for its sweet and slightly nutty taste. Number 12, cottage pie. This everyday comfort food is essentially a way to disguise leftovers, says Scully. The layered casserole is simple. The previous night's stew is topped with mashed potatoes and then baked. Number 13, black pudding. Black pudding, or blood sausage, is typically served at breakfast, but can be enjoyed throughout the day, says Scully. Number 14, Irish breakfast. This classic is a real smorgasbord that generally includes fried rashers, thin slices of bacon, fried sausages, fried eggs, fried tomatoes, fried mushrooms, white and black pudding, baked beans, and toast, says Claudia Lawless, an Irish-American and co-owner of the Dearborn. Number 15, trifle. This layered dessert traditionally contains custard, sherry or fruit juice-soaked sponge cake, or lady fingers, fruits, jam, and whipped cream, says Amy Lawless. Number 16, oysters. Ireland is primarily known for more earthy food options, but it's actually a haven of great mollusks, specifically on the coast of Galway. The oyster, not the potato, should be the symbol of Irish food, Bloomberg reported in 2018. That article describes the native flat oysters as gamey. The difference between them and Pacific oysters is like a double IPA compared with Bud Light. Number 17, Irish potato farls. Not dissimilar to boxty, farls are a kind of baked potato bread served for breakfast, per The Guardian. They're typically made by combining potatoes, butter, flour, and baking powder, with the dough being cut into four symmetrical pieces. Farl means fourths in Gaelic. Per allrecipes.com, farls can even be made with leftover mashed potatoes, which work well because of their lightness. Number 18, Berry Fool. The berry fool is a delicious treat and a testament to Europe as a whole. While it's popular in England and Ireland, its name may come from the French verb fouler, meaning to crush, though that has been disputed. This feathery fruit dessert can be made with nearly any kind of berry and involves mashing them and combining them with chilled heavy cream for a refreshing dish. Number 19, Barmbrack. This Irish sweetbread is typically associated with Halloween. Similar to the plastic baby that often comes in Mardi Gras king cakes, a ring is generally placed within the barmbrack and the person who finds it is said to have good luck. Number 20, Dublin Coddle. An effective comfort meal, Irish coddle combines sausage, and sometimes bacon, with potatoes and gravy. The whole thing is then slow-cooked, giving it a consistency similar to Irish stew. It's a perfect hearty winter dinner. As noted by May Reed of IrishAmericanMom.com, it's important to try and use Irish pork sausage, which has a more subtle flavor than many other variants. Our next article by Grant Rindner is The Most Popular St. Patrick's Day Traditions. Few holidays have transformed quite like St. Patrick's Day. It began in Ireland as a way to honor the country's patron saint, but through both immigration and secularization, it has now become a worldwide day to pay tribute to all things Irish. The date, March 17th, is one of the few constants over the years. According to History.com, St. Patrick's Day has been celebrated in Ireland for more than a millennium. It was a time to cut loose during the Catholic Lent season, and as such, it quickly became synonymous with Irish food and drink. When immigrants from Ireland moved to the U.S. and other places, they brought the tradition of St. Patrick's Day with them, and it morphed and modernized into what it's become now. Today, the holiday is honored in myriad ways around the world, ranging from the preparation of classic Irish food like Colcannon and Dexter beef, to adorning homes with clever green and gold decorations, and even making leprechaun traps. Though the festivities have changed over the centuries, St. Patrick's Day's traditions still showcase much of what makes Irish culture so unique. The shamrock is a St. Patrick's Day symbol that dates back to the 1700s. Per History.com, the shamrock has long been a piece of Irish iconography because it symbolizes the rebirth of spring. According to Time, shamrocks are a trefoil plant and were worn by poorer Irish citizens to church ceremonies on St. Patrick's Day in order to look nice. Irish immigrants who moved to America in the 1700s brought the symbol and image of the shamrock stateside as a way of paying tribute to their heritage. It has a deeper significance as it relates to St. Patrick's Day too, since St. Patrick himself is said to have used the shamrock's three leaves to explain the Christian concept of the Holy Trinity. Religious services are common to honor Ireland's patron, St. Patrick. Though Ireland is growing more diverse over time, the country's predominant religion remains Catholicism. St. Patrick's Day has strong Christian roots, per history.com, that date the holiday back more than 1,000 years. St. Patrick himself lived in the 5th century, beginning life as a slave and ultimately serving as Ireland's patron saint. It is said he was instrumental in bringing Christianity to his adopted homeland of Ireland, where he reportedly constructed schools and churches. As history.com notes, Roman Catholics celebrate St. Patrick's Day with a feast. The holiday itself falls in the middle of Lent, the period of personal asceticism that is meant to draw parallels between an individual's sacrifice and the 40 days Jesus is said to have spent wandering the desert. For many, St. Patrick's Day is a break in the middle of Lent, when they can have one extravagant meal before returning to fasting. Catholic churches around the world may also have religious services to commemorate St. Patrick's Day. Irish food like corned beef, cabbage, and soda bread are plentiful. One of the signature St. Patrick's Day dishes is corned beef and cabbage, a staple of any good holiday feast. Although a Smithsonian magazine notes, it's actually an Irish-American meal that is not nearly as popular in Ireland. Many Irish immigrants in the U.S. got their meat from kosher butchers, who were often their neighbors in densely populated urban areas, and so it's more accurately described as Jewish corned beef thrown into a pot with cabbage and potatoes. Smithsonian reports that in Ireland, the more traditional St. Patrick's Day dish is often lamb or bacon. Irish soda bread is another food with surprising origins. It was apparently pioneered by indigenous Americans who used pearl ash in lieu of yeast, but became popular in Ireland in the mid-1800s. At the time, the country's financial struggles made it necessary to make something filling, simple, and inexpensive. Beyond those two, expect your St. Patrick's Day plate to contain some shepherd's pie, coal cannon, mashed potatoes and cabbage, and lots of things that are dyed in a specially verdant shade of green. Many meals are washed down with a cold pint. If you're imbibing on St. Patrick's Day, odds are you'll be drinking some sort of beer. Inexpensive beer in the U.S. is often dyed green for the holiday, which Vox traced all the way back to the year 1910. It ballooned in popularity during the 50s and is now common for bars that cater to St. Paddy's Day revelers. For obvious reasons, Irish varieties of beer are favorites on the holiday. Guinness told USA Today that roughly 3 million pints of it are drunk on the holiday, up from 600,000 on a normal day. Though beer is quite popular, there are many other beverage options, including cocktails using whiskey and Baileys, as well as non-alcoholic choices like shamrock shakes. The leprechaun functions as the day's mythical mascot. Along with the shamrock, the leprechaun is another fixture of St. Patrick's Day celebrations. These stout creatures have been a staple of Celtic folklore for centuries. Per history.com, their original name, Lubberson, means small-bodied fellow. Parades around the world typically feature leprechauns, occasionally performing daredevilish feats. According to CBS News, leprechauns originally were clad in red, not their now signature green. In the 1900s, green became the de facto color associated with Irish culture, and eventually spread to leprechauns. Part of the hue change is also attributed to The Leprechaun, a popular poem by William Allingham in which the titular character wears green. Leprechauns are often depicted with a pot of gold, which humans can only find by catching one of them. It's why making the aforementioned leprechaun traps is a popular pastime for young children on March 17th. But don't feel bad if your St. Patrick's Day celebration is light on leprechauns. They have their own unofficial holiday on May 13th. Irish music, both modern and of the traditional folk variety, is often played live. A sailie is an Irish social gathering usually centered around dancing to traditional Irish music. Ireland has its share of musical instruments that get the chance to shine during St. Patrick's Day performances. These include the bodhran, a special drum, the Celtic harp, the fiddle, and the uilleann pipes, which are played similarly to Scottish bagpipes but are softer in tone. Irish cultural groups in the U.S. also organize sealies and teach the specific form of Gaelic dance that usually accompanies the folk music. These gatherings are not limited solely to St. Patrick's Day, but are a common way to celebrate Irish culture on the holiday itself. More modern pop music from the Irish diaspora is typically played during secular St. Patrick's Day celebrations in many cities. This often includes the work of influential acts like the folk group The Dubliners, superstar rock band U2, and influential punk act The Pogues. And if you're anywhere in the Northeast, you can bet you'll hear I'm Shipping Up to Boston by the Dropkick Murphys. Beware of pinchers in your midst. One peculiar bit of St. Patrick's Day lore involves the pinching of people who don't have any green garments on. Per the Independent, this dubious legend comes from the idea that only those wearing the holiday's signature color are invisible to the mischievous fingers of leprechauns who enjoy pinching and playing pranks. It's a good thing to be aware of if you're going to be out with a crowd on St. Patrick's Day, but we think it's probably best to keep your fingers to yourself. Parades are a common way to celebrate the diffusion of Irish people and culture across the world, especially in Japan. According to Time, the first American St. Patrick's Day parade happened all the way back in 1760 in Boston. Annual parades have been a staple since then, with major ones happening in cities like New York and Chicago. The latter is also famous for dyeing the Chicago River green. Ireland also has its own parades in Dublin and Belfast. These celebrations include Irish music, marchers clad in traditional attire, and plenty of green, white, and orange to match the Irish flag. Another hotspot is Japan, where the I Love Ireland Festival and Tokyo's St. Patrick's Day Parade have drawn as many as 180,000 attendees. According to Irish Central, there are strong cultural ties between Japan and Ireland due to their shared history as insular island cultures, and the flourishing of Irish music and dance in Japan. The 2020 film Explore, Dream, Discover Together, Ireland and Japan, explores the growing connection between the two nations. However, due to the coronavirus pandemic, many parades in major American cities have been canceled or pushed back. And while 2022 St. Patrick's Day is likely to look different than it has in previous years, there are still plenty of ways for you, your Teaghlach, and your Ceard to get in touch with Irish culture and celebrate. Our next article by Bridget Earley is titled, How to Make the Best Leprechaun Trap Your Kids Will Adore. Sir Charms, aka the leprechaun after your Lucky Charms, might be the most iconic leprechaun of the bunch, but word on the street is that plenty of these mischievous little characters pop up around St. Patrick's Day. They're tricky little fellas that can only be caught with a leprechaun trap that lures them to their fate with the most tempting bait, gold coins and sweet treats like candy and green desserts. Okay, no matter how much candy and gold you have at your disposal, you aren't actually going to catch any leprechauns. But building a leprechaun trap is still a great St. Patrick's Day activity, and one that's commonly done in schools for good reason. It's not only a fun way to celebrate the Day of the Irish, but it also teaches kids important STEM skills. Here's how to make an easy DIY leprechaun trap that actually works. But hang on, what exactly is a leprechaun trap? Think of a leprechaun trap as a more elaborate version of leaving milk and cookies out for Santa Claus. In the days leading up to St. Patrick's Day, you help your kids build the leprechaun trap, fill it with bait, gold coins, candy, rainbows, anything that might strike a leprechaun's fancy, then leave it out before bed on March 16th, St. Patrick's Day Eve. While the kids sleep, the leprechaun will visit the trap and take the bait. So what's in it for the preschoolers? Some parents get creative by leaving little footprints or a note from the leprechaun. Others give some kind of treat or reward for tykes to find in the morning. Sold. First, build the trap. You can make a leprechaun trap out of virtually anything. A shoebox, an empty oatmeal canister, cereal box, bowls, Legos, a long-abandoned mousetrap game, you name it. Of course, you'll also need plenty of craft supplies to make the trap enticing. Markers, paint, glitter, craft sticks, wrapping paper, tissue paper, pipe cleaners, it's all fair game. Then you add the bait. Gold is, of course, the ideal bait for greedy leprechauns. If you have chocolate coins on hand, those work well. Otherwise, you can paint cardboard circles gold or yellow. Bonus points for adding glitter. Lots of glitter. Other ideas include tons of green, a leprechaun's favorite color, four-leaf clovers, rainbows, Lucky Charms cereal, Skittles, green M&Ms, Rolos, Ring Pops, green desserts, think cookies or mini cupcakes. And don't forget, no peeking. Leprechauns are smart little buggers, and there's no chance you'll catch one with prying eyes around. Our next article, as told to Elena Nicolou, is titled, I Was the Berlin State Ballet's First Black Ballerina, but it wasn't what I'd hoped for. You could say that Swan Lake changed my life. When I was 6, my mom took me to Paris to see my first ballet performance, which was, you guessed it, Swan Lake. I was instantly taken with the art form, enamored by the costumes, sets, and most of all, the dancers. Upon returning home to Nice, a coastal city in southern France, I said, Mama, I want to become a ballerina. Turns out my dreams were within reach if I devoted my entire life to them. As the daughter of a cleaning woman of French and Algerian descent and a construction worker from Cape Verde, a coastal nation in Africa, I felt at odds among the daughters of doctors and lawyers at my dance academy. We were in different social classes. My mom had to take a second job to pay for my dance lessons. But when it came to the dancing itself, I could keep up. More than that, I excelled. At the age of 14, I left France to attend the Bolshoi Academy in Moscow, one of the most prestigious ballet schools in the world, and I eventually became one of those swans I saw on stage as a girl. In my career as a professional ballerina, I went on to dance in Swan Lake at many companies throughout Europe, including Ballet de l'Opéra de Nice. After years in the small town of Lucerne, Switzerland, I wanted a change, which is how I landed in Berlin. And it was during a performance of Berlin's Staatsballet, or State Ballet, Germany's leading ballet company, that Swan Lake changed my life yet again. Days after I joined the Staatsballet in 2018 as a member of the Corps de Ballet, we began rehearsals for Swan Lake. There in the theater, a journalist informed me of something I didn't know. I was the company's first ever black dancer. She asked how I felt. I said I was proud, but I didn't want my skin color to become a topic. Essentially, I didn't want to become a star because of my skin color, but because of my skill. Of the 500 women who auditioned for the Staatsballet's Corps de Ballet that year, I was one of 6 given a position. I didn't know it then, but the color of my skin would define my experience at the Staatsballet. Soon, the ballet mistress who presided over all the Corps de Ballet's day-long rehearsals made that very, very clear. From the start, she picked on me as if I didn't know how to do my job, as if I hadn't been one of 6 women out of 500 to make it to the Staatsballet that year. She'd say, Chloe, your foot isn't on line, or Chloe, your body isn't aligned, often snipping at me in Russian, our only common language. I had picked up Russian while studying at the Bolshoi Academy. If I ever thought it was just my imagination, I knew it wasn't when my colleague started to say, she has it out for Chloe. While we all were critiqued, the barrage of insults was constant for me. I felt that she was especially fixated on my skin color. Once I remember she said, Chloe, when you're not in line, we see only you because you're black. Why couldn't she just tell me to be in line? Another time, she asked my colleagues and I to take a photo matching one she had on her phone of a black ballerina surrounded by 3 blondes. France had human zoos until the mid-20th century, places where you could see people deemed curiosities. While posing for that photo, I felt like an exhibit in one of those zoos. Then came the comment that finally made me brave enough to speak to my ballet's co-artistic director, Johannes Ohmann, who had championed my admission into the Staatsballet. While rehearsing for La Bayadere, a 19th century ballet set in India, the ballet mistress was handing out veils to everyone, but when she reached me, she told me that I could not have a veil. The veil is white and you are black, she said, laughing. Stunned, I asked her to repeat what she said. She did, willingly. Ullman said there was virtually nothing I could do. My ballet mistress was appointed by the government, which meant she would hold her position for life. When I called my boyfriend crying after one of those racist incidents, he asked a question you might be asking yourself. Why didn't my colleagues do anything? I love my boyfriend, but he doesn't know the world of ballet. There are power dynamics at play. My ballet mistress has a government-appointed position while the other dancers and I have yearly contracts. We'd also been taught from a young age to accept mistreatment from our mistresses. I'd seen cruelty like that since I was a kid. It's all normal. You just shut your mouth. That's ballet. So I kept going, arriving at rehearsals with a twisted stomach. Sometimes I wanted to throw up. A year in, the happy person I used to be had disappeared. A doctor prescribed me antidepressants for the first time in my life. Then I injured my leg. I took an 8-month break because of my injury and my mental health. When I returned for another performance of Swan Lake in 2020, things got worse. Back when I first joined Staats Ballet and Ullman was still artistic director, he ended the company's practice of having ballet dancers powder their skin to create a sense of uniformity that was supposedly crucial to the show. In fact, some artistic directors don't think black ballerinas can be in a traditional Swan Lake at all because the presence of darker skin disrupts the aesthetic of an unbroken line. After Ullman announced his departure in January 2020, my ballet mistress asked me to apply white makeup on my face for Swan Lake. She said everyone needs to powder their skin white to blend in. As the only black ballet dancer at the Staats Ballet at the time, I felt she asked me to do so because she didn't want me to stand out because of my skin color. Ullman's replacement, the ballet's acting artistic director, Christiane Theobald, looked surprised when she saw me with the makeup on and told me to stop powdering my face. I never wore that makeup again. Soon after this incident, all shows for Swan Lake, which was set to premiere in March 2020, were canceled due to the pandemic. In response to a request for comment, the Staats Ballet said that ballet mistresses don't have the power to decide about makeup. This is an artistic decision that comes from the choreographer or the artistic direction. The rule from Johannes Ullman that Chloe Lopez Gomez doesn't need to use makeup was never withdrawn. It was an ongoing rule also after he left. My boyfriend encouraged me to speak out about what had happened to me. My sister, a former ballerina, also told me to speak out. But I only decided I was ready after I lost what I'd been so intent on keeping, my job. In June of 2020, I was among 12 dancers out of about 90 who were told our contracts wouldn't be renewed. Their reasoning? The pandemic's financial pressures and that I didn't fit with the company. Theobald, the ballet's acting artistic director, told me, "You're not good enough," and that I had a lack of musicality. Can you imagine that, a lack of musicality after 20 years? My contract was set to expire in July 2021, which meant I still had to dance at the Staats Ballet for another year. And that's when I started talking. Over the last year, I've shared the experience of my circumstances as a dancer at the Staats Ballet in outlets around the world, like the New York Times and The Guardian, and brought a lawsuit against the company. I was determined to fight until the end, even though it's scary to attack a huge institution, especially when connected to and subsidized by the government. As my story was covered by papers around the world, I still had to go to work. The ballet mistress and I didn't make eye contact when we passed each other. I worried the judge might do the same, review my case, then ignore me completely. By late April, the Staats Ballet and I had arrived at an out-of-court settlement, avoiding the uncertainty of a drawn-out trial. As part of the settlement, the Staats Ballet agreed to pay me 16,000 euro, about 19,000 US dollars, as compensation, and to continue my employment at the company for another year. While the Staats Ballet and ballet mistress did not acknowledge wrongdoing in the settlement, and there was no finding by a court with respect to the liability of the Staats Ballet or the ballet mistress, I felt that the settlement was a win for me. At the courthouse, the acting artistic director, Theobald, called my allegations a wake-up call. I hope she means it. I hope Staats Ballet becomes more diverse as a result of my fight. Personally, I'll believe it when I see it. Afterward, Theobald met me after the hearing and promised she would try her best to make me safe and happy. Still, I knew I'd have to work with the ballet mistress when I returned in the summer. My stomach was in knots. I didn't want to be the witness of my misery again. Getting a spot at another company during COVID-19 would be a struggle. But when you really want something, you have to push yourself. After months of working with a private trainer, I auditioned to be part of Ballet de Rennes, a small company located in France, in July. A few days after the audition, the ballet's artistic director, Bruno Bruch, took me out for coffee in Paris. We had a refreshing conversation. Above all, he said he's concerned with his dancers' well-being. If you don't feel happy in your work, he said, you won't be a good dancer. His words felt so right. All I want is to grow artistically and blossom as a dancer. Here, hopefully, I'll be able to. Some of my colleagues were surprised when I announced I was leaving the Staats Ballet after all the effort I'd put in to win my contract back. But why? I perform because it makes me happy. Why should I stay in the company where clearly I've struggled? No, I'm leaving with my head high. It's time for me to move on. Anyway, this isn't about me. It's about all of ballet. Change needs to happen to make ballet more inclusive because the art form should be for all of us, no matter our skin color or income level. At every turn, my story has an example of something that can be fixed. There needs to be makeup for black ballerinas and hairstylists trained for curly hair. All this time I've been doing my own. And skin-inclusive dancewear. Ballet instructors need more formal pedagogy to curb abuse. Ballet lessons need to be more accessible to kids whose parents can't necessarily afford lessons. The list goes on and on, but most of all, we need to start talking. If you keep silent, things can only get worse. What I've learned is that change can happen so long as we break the silence. At the Paris Opera in the fall of 2020, 1,800 employees, including my brother, a ballet dancer, wrote an open letter demanding an end to racist practices like blackface and yellowface. The institution responded with a 66-page report detailing the state of diversity within its ranks and a commitment to change. As a girl, I thought ballet saved my life. It gave me access to a world I never would have reached otherwise, and it gave me a way out of my problems, a place where I could focus on nothing but my body. After all this time, I still feel freedom when I'm in costume. I blend into the music, the characters. I lose myself. And off stage, I found myself. Turns out I'm stronger than I ever could have known. Sometimes I wish I never had to find out. Editor's note, Oprah Daily attempted to reach out to the ballet mistress through the Staats Ballet, but did not receive a response back from the mistress or from the company on behalf of the mistress. Our next article by Halma Marcus is titled, What or Who is a Horse Girl? A new book looks at the feminine equine bond. In Horse Girls, Halima Marcus, executive director of Electric Literature, has compiled a graceful and straight-shooting compendium of essays. The vignettes are penned by women including Carmen Maria Machado, Maggie Shipstead, Jane Smiley, and others about their equestrian experiences. It's a book that tramples over the misconceptions of what or who a horse girl even is. In this adapted excerpt from the book, Marcus writes achingly about her own long and winding path to rediscovering joys of horseback riding after a long time away. This past January, as my New Year's resolution, I started taking riding lessons again. The farm I've chosen is on a winding country road tracked with red clay from the unpaved driveways. There, I'm given a tour and instructions to tack up Woody, the 17-hand paint I will ride in my lesson. I'm shown the tack room with hooks for cleaning bridles, saddle pads stacked a dozen high, and the office, walls lined with faded ribbons and dusty trophies. Every barn I've been to has some version of these spaces, each unique in its particulars, but sensorially the same. In one hand, I carry the green plastic tack box I got for my 11th birthday, and under my arm is the brimless crash helmet I wore when I galloped cross-country as a teenager. It has been 15 years since I've ridden regularly, 10 since my last lesson, but the routines return to me easily. There's a hierarchy at all barns. The trainer, Debbie in this case, is at the top, followed by the most dedicated riders who tend to have the most expensive horses. Riders who neither lease nor own a horse are near the bottom. These are the riders who mount lesson horses, which are usually some combination of old, fat, and slow. A riding friend of mine used to say these horses were dead to the world because nothing startles them. They are dependable, they won't shy at an open door, They'll let you touch their faces and ears and girth. Often there are stories about these horses' glory days. Woody, the horse I'm riding, is 21, but used to be a star show jumper, I'm told. Now he leads an easier life carrying inexperienced, or in my case, formerly experienced, riders around the indoor ring. At my first lesson, it's very important to me that I let everyone know how long it's been and exactly how good I used to be. I did the whole thing. Competitions every weekend, 3-foot-6 fences, ditches, drops, and water jumps, polished leather and pressed stock ties, dressage tests and leg yields. I still have my seat, straight spine, loose hips, shoulders square, but the obscure muscles on the insides of my thighs haven't been properly exercised in years. I struggle to make Woody go. Our trot has no impulsion. He breaks from the canter. Debbie's firm commands are comforting in their familiarity. Hands higher, softer, toes in, heels down. She identifies the bad habits that used to plague me in my eventing days, a hip that tilts in around turns, a seat that drives when it should be light. Debbie self-describes as tough. I don't baby people, she tells me, but I wouldn't have wanted her to. 15 minutes in and already I feel myself returning to the star pupil I used to be, lengthening my spine, answering yes instead of yeah. Am I boring you, my former trainer used to say, if I ever yawned in her presence, even when we gathered at the barn in the purple pre-dawn the morning of a show. I know how to elicit and appreciate love from women like this. Strong, independent businesswomen who demonstrate affection by raising jumps and taking away your stirrups. By inviting you to ride in the truck with them or giving you a private lesson during an unexpectedly free hour. By pushing you, which, if you speak their language, means they believe in you. By keeping expectations always one notch higher than the level where you are. I was once a horse girl, but I never became a horse woman. Horsewomen are tough, no-nonsense, fit but weathered, usually with a bad knee or some old injury acting up, but still always up early, riding every day, birthdays, New Year's, and snowstorms, and on Christmas. Unsentimental about horses, but devoted to them for life. Women like Debbie, but not me. I stopped riding when I went to college, quitting the sport at the final edge of girlhood. I look back on it now as inevitable, the forces of money, time, and education conspiring against me. But then it felt like a crossroads. I could either attend a local school, maybe even major in equine studies at one of the rural institutions, or I could pursue a liberal arts degree at a more demanding and prestigious university. The former option would have allowed me to live at home and continue to ride competitively, working towards a professional career. The latter would be the first step on a path to pursue my quieter dream to become a writer. As I approached the end of high school, I believed that if I became a writer, I would never be a writer. Both because I wouldn't be educated as a writer, and because the world of horses, as I knew it, had nothing in common with the world of arts and letters. If I continued to ride, I not only wouldn't be a writer, I wouldn't know any either. This either-or dichotomy, like most dichotomies, was based on a series of unexplored assumptions. Of course there are writers who are also writers. I found 14 of them for the book I've edited, Horse Girls, and there are many more I wish I could have included. Back then, as a senior in high school, I chalked the choice up to logistics. How would I ride if I was busy at school? How would I get a good education if I was busy riding? When really, it was based on a more insidious assumption that if I rode, my life would lack creativity and inspiration. If I rode, I wouldn't have anything to write about. Wanting to make a clean break, I applied early decision to an elite liberal arts school that did not have an equestrian team and got in. My parents made plans to lease my horse Dave so that I could come home and ride him on holidays and weekends. On the first day of riding class, freshman year, we were asked to introduce ourselves by providing a unique piece of trivia. I used to be heavily into riding, I said when it was my turn, though I had quit practically yesterday and technically still owned a horse. Only as the words came out did I realize that I sounded like a snob, that the word heavily was awkward, unintelligent. My classmates looked at me blankly. "So am I," chimed another girl. Already, I could tell she was friendly and enthusiastic and had no sense of irony. A full-on horse girl. I'd admitted the same about myself just a few moments earlier, but at least I had the good sense to be embarrassed by it. Later, she joined the college's extracurricular writing club and proudly strode across campus in her jodhpurs, wrote stories in college about sentimental relationships with horses, while the rest of us tried to find a voice as serious writers. My school was nearly 5 hours away from home by train. Dave was sold by Christmas. Over the next 4 years, I reinvented myself as anything but a horse girl. I played indie music on the college radio station, dressed in vintage clothes, and wrote moody short stories that didn't feature any animals, let alone horses. Horse girls were unfashionable, out of touch, unsophisticated. My new hobbies were obscure and exclusive, my demeanor disaffected. My assumption that horses could never be subjects of literary merit remained unchallenged. In fact, I didn't believe that anything in my life was worth writing about. I made fun of classmates who set their stories in dormitories and on the quad, in their childhood bedrooms and high school hallways. I wrote stories that had nothing to do with me, that blatantly imitated the type of work we were assigned in class. Stories about stoic longshoremen, single mothers driving cross-country, and alcoholic brides getting cold feet. Yet I had no interest in inventing a cowboy with a trusty Mustang or an heiress with a stable full of racehorses, a lonely farm girl with a stubborn mare. When I tried to push my imagination beyond imitation, all I got were more cliches. I used these stories to get into graduate school in New York, an MFA program in fiction, where I by now had some idea about how to fit in with the urbane, liberal, and artistic individuals I wanted to be like. My writing grew more personal, but writing remained a source of shame, something I rarely mentioned or talked about only jokingly. It seemed aristocratic and conservative, a bucolic fantasy that had no place in New York City. And yet, I pined after it privately. From my life in the city, this pining was necessarily done at a remove. My Instagram feed filled up with horses. I watched live streams of competitions on the weekends. I had a recurring fantasy that a lesson horse in Prospect Park would get loose during one of my regular runs and I would dash valiantly to the rescue. Unlike a doctor, who might reasonably be called upon at any moment, does anyone know how to ride a horse is not a question I was likely to encounter anywhere for any reason. Instead of growing out of my love for horses, as I always assumed I would, I felt that horses were drawing closer, demanding more attention, becoming more insistent in their absence. I confided in my new boyfriend, whom I met in the writing program, about how much I missed writing. Though we'd only been dating a few months, he arranged for me to have a lesson at a farm in New Jersey for my 25th birthday. "I thought you'd be wearing the outfit," he said, disappointed when he saw me dressed in the navy blue riding pants, padded boots, and half chaps my mom had mailed from Pennsylvania for the occasion. You know, those tan leggings and tall boots. I knew the look, the magazine perfect horse girl he imagined, but was still surprised to hear him desire her so bluntly. As a girl, I'd coveted that image in an asexual way, wanting the perfection, the thinness. Instead of questioning what it was about, the equestrian uniform, prim and prescribed like a Catholic schoolgirl's, that he found so alluring, I thought instead that there was no way my tall boots, which I hadn't worn in years, would fit now. Just the mention of those boots recalled the compression socks and the baby powder, the boot pulls and the boot jack, the phantom of Charlie Horse's past, a display I could no longer muster. The lesson was at a dressage stable helmed by a former Olympian, and the horse they put me on, while technically a lesson horse, could still do pee-offs and passages, flying lead changes and extended trots. I had never ridden a horse purely trained for dressage. The thoroughbreds I invented in Pennsylvania sacrificed flair for power. During the lesson, I felt that feeling rider's chase, complete syncopation with my steed, a half ton of muscle and flesh floating above the ground. After, sweaty and proud, I asked my boyfriend what he thought. My beaming face anticipated the praise I was about to receive. He told me he hadn't realized he was supposed to watch, as if the outfit was the only show. He'd spent the whole time waiting in the car. Still, I told friends the lesson was the best present anyone has ever given me and interpreted it as a sign that this boyfriend really knew me, that he saw value in my dreams, even the dream I was embarrassed to admit to, the one I'd permanently deferred. I realized I'd given him too much credit when he later reported to me a hilarious conversation he had with our classmate about how weird horse girls are. He told me this without any inclination that I would be insulted, as if I would agree enthusiastically, as if even as the alleged horse girl I could still be in on the joke. The boyfriend and I didn't last, and these slights were admittedly minor. I consider it a flaw in my character that ever since I was one of those weird horse girls myself, I've been susceptible to an eye roll, to a laugh at my expense. Writing this, I'm even embarrassed to admit how long that moment has stayed with me. I should have forgotten it years ago. But there's no ignoring that I waited 10 years to have another lesson until the day I rode Woody. My ex-boyfriend's comment tapped into an insecurity, a suspicion that the sport I love limited me to an array of contradictory cliches. An overzealous misfit, a girl with her head in the pastures, a princess devoted to ponies and privilege, a dominatrix with high boots and crop. Unlike other sports, which are as ingrained into our national consciousness as the seasons, competitive riding inspires only other riders. It doesn't foster civic pride or cross-cultural conversation. It doesn't give you something to talk about with your neighbor or your coworker or your dad. Outside of tight-knit riding communities, its value is primarily personal, deriving from the bond between rider and horse, a bond that can feel ancient, even spiritual, but is nonetheless about subordination, a bond made possible by centuries of domestication. One weekend a few years ago, I retreated to a friend's cabin to work on an assignment that would eventually inspire this anthology. My longing to ride, but inability to fit it into my life, had finally taken up enough space in my mind that I had no choice but to write about it. It was the first time I'd attempted to write about horses, and everything I came up with felt myopic and indulgent. I left my desk and went for a walk in the woods, following whatever path called to me, uncharacteristically without a map or a plan. I headed down one trail hoping it would loop back around, but as it kept going, a feeling pestered me. If I continued, I would soon be lost. When I turned to retrace my steps, I saw spray painted on a boulder, "When we ride a horse, we borrow freedom." As far as I knew, riders did not use this park. This was not horse country. The message had been at my back, and had I not turned around, I never would have seen it. The message had been written for me. Freedom, yes. Freedom was a feeling I got from riding, though I would have been too self-conscious to put it so plainly. Galloping all four legs off the ground, six if you count mine. People can't help but compare it to flying, and that word, borrow. The best horse and rider relationships have a give and take, their own language, a physical communication. When we ride a horse, we don't take their freedom. Their freedom is not lost by being ridden. We borrow it. They share it with us. It is not depleted by being shared, and it is endlessly replenished. Freedom is not bestowed upon a horse. It is an innate quality that horses, even in captivity, embody and exude. Horses are free in ways that humans can only sample. We do not permit horses to be free because that kind of freedom is not a gift that humans have to give. The average lifespan of a horse is 25 to 33 years. Their prime ages for racing are between 7 and 10, 11 to 17 for other disciplines like show jumping and eventing. An 18-year-old dressage horse is an elder statesman. Horses age much like humans. Their hair becomes flecked with gray, their face is hollow. Concavities appear above their eyes rather than at their cheeks. Their joints ache, they grow stiff. When they sleep, their lips hang slack. At 35, I am at the upper end of a horse's lifespan, decidedly a woman, no longer a girl. Finally mature enough to be in on, or at least on the outside of, the horse girl joke. There wasn't a precise moment when I stopped being a girl and became a woman, but while I haven't been a girl a long time, there were many years when I was both. In my riding heyday, my horse Dave and I were the same age. My parents bought him when I was 16, when I was rising to the highest ranks I would ever achieve in equestrian competition, and he, unbeknownst to me, had just passed his. That we were the same age felt at once cosmically significant, but also like a bit of novel trivia. At 16, I was checking off milestones, doing all the things teenagers do to grow up, but I was still a young rider. At the same age, Dave was an experienced competitor, had placed in the top five at high-level three-day events. I was his second or third or maybe fourth owner. He had already brought one of the older girls at the barn up through the levels. Predictably, she sold him to me when she went off to college. Any rider who doesn't quit, who stays in it for their lifetime, will outlive their horse. A few years ago, when I heard that David died, I cried as I might have done if it had happened when I was young, if he had died when I still knew him. Though I'd long since grown up and moved on, though it had been years since I'd last felt the weight of one of his hooves in my palm, since I'd pressed my forehead onto the base of his neck, since I'd watched him gleefully cake his freshly bathed coat in mud, losing him made me a girl again. When does a girl become a woman? Is it when she turns 18 and becomes a legal adult? Is it when she loses her virginity, or when she first experiences a loss that forces maturity, or a trauma that shatters her naive sense of invincibility? When does a horse girl get to become a horse woman, a horse person? We cling to the child within us by reliving our past glory, by taking our hobbies seriously, by identifying with old insecurities, and we fight it by putting ourselves at risk, by taking on more than we can handle, by denying our simple passions. But all that thrashing does nothing to forestall the natural way of things. A horse lives 3 decades, from rambunctious colt to seasoned athlete to lesson horse. The older the horse, the younger or more inexperienced the rider. By returning to a lesson horse, I was humbled, forced to admit that I'd given up my place, that I still had a lot to learn. I was also compelled to admit that the divisions between the two sides of myself, which I had previously considered irreconcilable, were of my own invention. As riders, as humans, we must take the lessons from horses that we can. If I could be an adult and ride a lesson horse, if I could be experienced and still be a beginner, maybe it was possible to love horses, to express that love in all its contradictions and nuance, and enjoy the ride. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.